you and welcome to today's media teleconference to discuss the Supreme Court's ruling in Milovitz, Gallup, and Milovitz versus the United States. I am ABI resident scholar Juliette Morangello, and I will be your moderator for this teleconference. The plaintiff in Milovitz, who is here on this call today, challenged several provisions of the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act of 2005, BAPSIPA, which amended the bankruptcy code. BAPSIPA created the new term debt relief agency and imposed several obligations and restrictions on these debt relief agencies. Under the bankruptcy code as amended by BAPSIPA, debt relief agencies must refrain from advising an assisted person or prospective assisted person to incur more debt in contemplation of such person filing a bankruptcy petition. In addition, a debt relief agency must comply with certain advertising disclosure requirements and must include in its advertisements a statement that we are a debt relief agency. We help people file for relief under the bankruptcy code. The United States Supreme Court ruled yesterday in the Milovitz case that attorneys who provide bankruptcy assistance to certain individual clients are included in the definition of debt relief agency under BAPSIPA. The court also upheld the prohibition on advising a client to take on more debt in contemplation of bankruptcy by narrowly reading the statute to prohibit only advice that would present a substantial risk of injury to both debtors and creditors. Furthermore, the court ruled that the attorney advertising disclosure requirements within BAPSIPA are intended to combat the problem of inherently misleading commercial advertisements, and they entail only an accurate statement of the advertiser's legal status and the character of the assistance provided, and are thus reasonably related to the government's interest in preventing consumer deception. Joining us today is a terrific panel of experts, including the petitioner in the case, to discuss the Supreme Court's ruling and the potential ramifications for bankruptcy practitioners and the bankruptcy code. The program will consist of about 30 minutes of opening commentary by our experts, and then we will take your questions. Our speakers are Robert J. Milovitz, the founder of Milovitz, Gallup, and Milovitz, and petitioner in the Milovitz case. He is joined by his associate, Chad Schultz, who argued this case in the Eighth Circuit. We also have William H. Schorling, who is a shareholder in Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney in Philadelphia, where he is chair of the firm's Bankruptcy and Creditors' Rights Group. Schorling is the counsel of record for the Commercial Law League of America's amicus brief in support of the petitioner, attorney Robert Milovitz. Professor Nancy B. Rappaport is the Gordon and Silver Limited professor at the William S. Boyd School of Law, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, where she teaches courses in bankruptcy and professional responsibility. Professor Rappaport has written extensively on bankruptcy attorney ethics. Last, we have Joseph Prochaska of Prochaska Thompson Quinn and Ferraro PC in Nashville, Tennessee. He has handled a variety of complex matters for some of the nation's largest lenders and companies. Prochaska has followed the Milovitz case closely and has provided commentary to the media on this case. I would like to thank our distinguished panel for joining us this afternoon, and I'd like to start the discussion with Bob Milovitz, whose firm brought this case. Bob, what concerned you most about the debt relief agency provisions and their effect on your practice?
The concerns that I basically had was, are our clients going to be getting honest advice? Can we fulfill the obligations as attorneys under our rules of professional responsibility and follow the requirements that Congress set out in the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention Consumer Protection Act, BAPSIPA. And I felt that this statute was terrible. I didn't feel that we could practice bankruptcy under the statute, and so we started a declaratory judgment to declare sections of it unconstitutional. The Bankruptcy Act, as written, was clearly unconstitutional, a violation of the First Amendment in at least two respects. One, it was overbroad, and two, it was vague. The Supreme Court addressed some of the overbreadth issues by narrowing it, but it's still too vague. We've discussed the act in my office, and we have four different opinions at least on what the Supreme Court decision means, and perhaps if this panel discussion we'll have other issues on misunderstanding or non-clarity on the opinion. First of all, I don't even agree with the first paragraph of the opinion that the purpose of the act was to correct perceived abuses in the bankruptcy system. I think it's clear that the purpose of the act has nothing to do with protecting the public or protecting creditors or anyone else other than certain creditors that are being discharged. And the act was written by lobbyists for credit card companies and banks and their attorneys. And the act was not designed to do anything other than reduce the number of bankruptcy filings. The act limits the advice that people can get. And certainly in the sections of advice, it's clear that the advice has to be limited because of the threats of sanctions against lawyers. Mm-hmm. And in the advertising section under 528, the public isn't informed adequately of that an attorney can help you and give you advice. So the act lumps attorneys together with bankruptcy petition preparers illegally. So what we wanted was clarity in the act, and that's why we started the suit. The district court judge did not jump right away to the issue of whether or not lawyers are debt relief agencies. That wasn't the issue that we asked for. The issue was whether or not the statute was overbroad and a violation of the First Amendment and vague and violated the First Amendment. The district court judge did not reach the issue of whether or not were debt relief agencies until after he found it unconstitutional. So as a matter of statutory mm-hmm. avoidance, right. The district court judge, Judge Rosenbaum, held that the Congress couldn't possibly have intended to include lawyers because it'd be unconstitutional. So he held that the bankruptcy BAPCPA did not intend to include lawyers, but that wasn't my major issue. My mm-hmm. major issue was to have it declared unconstitutional so that the public can get clear, honest advice. And what's happened after the decision is there isn't an improvement on the clarity of the statute because the decision doesn't adequately narrow the statute, and it doesn't cover a lot of issues that we could discuss that aren't covered. So I think it's very difficult for an attorney to practice ethically under the statute and honestly answer questions that clients have.
Well, thank you, and we're so glad to have you here, given that you're the one who brought this case, and I think our other speakers do want to weigh in on the impact that this decision will have on the ability of lawyers to best represent their clients. And I'd actually like to start with the definition of debt relief agency. And I want to turn to Joe. Joe, you have referred to the designation as debt relief agency as a badge of honor for debtors' attorneys. What do you mean by that?
Well, Congress has, in several instances, called attorneys by terms without specifically referencing attorneys in the statute. I want to go back about 25 or 30 years ago to the Federal Debt Collection Practices Act, where it was ultimately found by the Supreme Court that attorneys were who collected debts were included within the definition of debt collectors. Attorneys weren't listed in that statute, but the Supreme Court eventually held that, yes, attorneys were debt collectors. Here, in the Milovitz decision, the Supreme Court has held that attorneys who help people file for bankruptcy, help consumers file for bankruptcy, are debt relief agents or are operating debt relief agencies. A lot of consumer debtors' attorneys wear that as a badge of honor, and I mean that literally. They'll have badges that they'll wear at conferences and the like that say on them debt relief agent or federal debt relief agent, and it's a little bit nicer term, I think, than debt collector. collector, to be a debt relief agent. But it is a term that I think anyone who helps consumers file for bankruptcy now has to identify themselves as a debt relief agent or operating a debt relief agency. So Congress did not specifically list attorneys in the statute, but the Supreme Court held in Milovitz that because of the nature of advice that attorneys give and the people that attorneys are representing, that they are operating debt relief agencies.
Sure. And of course, it was important for the court to make that decision because that raises the other issues in the case as to whether the, for instance, prohibition on giving certain advice to clients is constitutional. Although, Joe, you know, you mentioned that debt relief agency means debtor attorneys, although the code doesn't say that. And Bill, in your amicus brief, you expressed concern that the definition of debt relief agency could apply to creditors' lawyers as well as debtors' lawyers. The Supreme Court yesterday rejected that interpretation, saying that the plain language of the statute indicates that only debtor attorneys are included. Do you agree with how the Supreme Court got there?
I'm not sure I agree with how the Supreme Court got there, although we agree with the conclusion. But as you pointed out, Julia, in Section 101.12a of the Bankruptcy Code, the term debt relief agency means any person who provides any bankruptcy assistance to an assisted person in return for the payment of money. Mm-hmm. And that certainly is broader than debtors' attorneys. We also filed an amicus in the Eighth Circuit appeal in the case below. And there, the Eighth Circuit held that it included creditors' attorneys within the definition of debt relief agency. The Supreme Court looked at two different sources for its interpretation of debt relief agency as excluding creditors' lawyers, and actually excluding any lawyer except a lawyer representing a debtor in connection with filing a case. One is that Section 528, which deals with the advertising provisions, and the other sections at issue, appear in the debtor provision of the Bankruptcy Code, mm-hmm. the Chapter 5, dealing with debtors' odd duties and obligations. And the second was that the court pointed out that three sections that are dealt with in the debt relief agency provisions deal with obligations of debtors. It's clearly the definition was broad enough on its face to include creditors' lawyers,
mm-hmm.
But the result was absurd if you did, because creditors' lawyers, if they represented assisted persons in connection with bankruptcy, would have to include the statement that they help people file for bankruptcy when they don't. So the Supreme Court narrowed the definition solely to lawyers who assist debtors in connection with filing their petition.
Sure.
Now, the Supreme Court narrowed the definition, and certainly Congress can define lawyers whatever they want. But the issue that we raised was not merely that the definition wasn't clear, but the most important issue we raised wasn't dealt with by the Supreme Court, and that's the First Amendment issue of compelled speech. There have been a number of cases where the U.S. Supreme Court does not allow a requirement of compelled speech. It may be a badge of honor to some lawyers, but our law firm didn't want to say we're debt relief agencies. We don't want to have the same yellow page ad that other debt relief agencies have, where we're all debt relief agencies and clients call up debt relief agency and get a bankruptcy petition preparer that'll file their petition for $200, well, we're forced under the Bankruptcy Act to charge a lot more and do a lot more work and have a lot more responsibility. So the issue for us wasn't whether or not it was overbroad and understandable, mm-hmm. but the issue was one of compelled speech. And we cited a case involving mushroom growers that didn't want to be lumped together with other mushroom growers. We cited a case on New Hampshire license plates where some people did not want to have live free or die on their license plates, and the U.S. Supreme Court held that those people did not have to include that on their license plate because this compelled speech a violation of the First Amendment. And also there are cases involving requirement to recite the Pledge of Allegiance under God. And the...
I'm going to just jump in. This is Chad Schultz. They did allow for the, in the opinion, for a same or similar statement. And there's a question as to whether technically you need to call yourself debt relief agency and use that phrase, and what is same or similar. And the Eighth Circuit left that open in their decision, and the Supreme Court left that open as well. So the question becomes, do you have to use the exact language that's there, saying debt relief agency, or can you use a same or similar language?
And Chad, this is Nancy. You bring up an important point. The problem is lawyers are so risk-averse that they're going to be very nervous trying to figure out what's same or similar, since now they know that certainly if they use the language in the statute, then they are complying, and as soon as you branch out, you worry about whether you're going to be sued for not being same or substantially similar.
And I think Bob mentioned a number of cases where with the mushroom growers and the people in New Hampshire. And Bob, what the Supreme Court did here was lump you not with other mushroom growers, but lumped you with creditors' lawyers. Creditors' lawyers have compelled speech now under the Federal Debt Collections Practices Act, where they have to make a disclosure in their communications with debtors saying that we are a federal, a debt collector, and that any information you give to us will be used for that purpose. So there's already compelled speech for creditors' lawyers. What this has simply done is made some compelled speech for debtors' lawyers as well.
It does a little more than that. It makes a compelled speech to limit our advertising. In other words, it goes beyond the collection lawyer's compelled speech. When you're writing a letter to a debtor, you tell them what you're doing. But this is an advertisement to the general public. And this can be, it's so overbroad when a lawyer that does bankruptcy has to put that on their calling card, on their letterhead.
Now remember, we are talking about commercial speech here, though.
Right.
What?
Go ahead, Nancy.
We're talking about commercial speech here, which is less protected than the things like the Live Free or Die license plate. Bob, I hear you, and I totally understand where you're coming from, but the Supreme Court was able to carve this off by saying it's not regular speech. It is commercial speech, and therefore it doesn't have as many protections. Whether Congress did the right thing or not, my guess is we're all going to say we hated the original statute, we don't think that it was aimed for the right purpose, and we think that the statute doesn't do what it says it did. But where I think the Supreme Court is coming from is there's a lot more options for Congress when it comes to commercial speech.
Clarence Thomas' concurring opinion is wonderful at how he states it, in that, you know, the commercial speech distinction really shouldn't be there, and there should be a potential heightened scrutiny that should be applied other than just traditional commercial speech, and the possibility of coming back to questioning Zauder. I found that very, very interesting in that concurring opinion. And while it's not, you know, binding at all, I thought, you know, this is an action by the court that maybe this is a door that may open later on, because the one thing that I'm worried about is this snowballing into more and more regulations of attorneys and defining attorneys and attorney bashing, things of that nature, as the upcoming legislation comes through in the healthcare debate with tort reform and caps and other issues that regard attorneys. If we start with debt relief agencies, what's the next step? Are we going to start to further subdivide it? Or are we going to go and, you know, move to a point where we have a federal malpractice statute wherein the Congress has the right to create federal malpractice? Where's the separation of powers here?
And you're right that traditionally this is a state function. States regulate attorney conduct, typically not the feds. You're absolutely right with that.
Yeah.
In the opinion, they just created a federal where Congress controls the actions of attorneys, which creates a federal ethics and malpractice type of area, which is traditionally not its function. And I'm not sure how this is going to play out in the years to come. But it does cause quite a bit of concern, and, you know, my my eyes going to be watching out for it as things proceed.
Well, that's
if
right.
Congress passes a law designed to protect our Internal Revenue Service from abusive advice from attorneys, can Congress pass a law prohibiting attorneys from giving advice on taking exemptions?
Well,
pass a law saying when a client comes to your office and wants to know about a charitable donation and making an exemption, giving some paintings to a museum or giving some money to the Red Cross or whatever, and the lawyer advises them to take an exemption, is this going to be the next step?
Well, let's turn.
Can we regulate lawyers?
Yeah, let's turn to that because you know we've talked about the compelled speech, we've talked about the advertising and the lower level of scrutiny that the court gives to commercial speech, and they classified the advertising as commercial speech. But the other area of concern, and Bob, it's a major one that you just mentioned, is the restrictions on advice that an attorney can give her clients. So let's talk for a moment about the prohibition on advising a client to incur more debt in contemplation of bankruptcy in Section 526A4, because what's really at issue here is a restriction on a lawyer's discretion in advising her clients. The court read the provision narrowly to prohibit only advice that would be harmful to debtors and creditors. Nancy, could you comment on Justice Sotomayor's narrow reading of the statute?
I certainly think that she did everything in her power to try to read that statute as narrowly as possible to find it constitutional, and her opinion is very carefully crafted. Mm-hmm. At the extreme, she's absolutely right, but lawyers never had the right to advise clients to do things that were illegal. This is nothing new. Mm-hmm. The problem with the opinion is, after reading it, I'm still not sure exactly what kind of advice I could give a client if I were representing a consumer debtor. We've always had the tension when we're helping people with pre-bankruptcy planning, especially consumers, when we're helping them with pre-bankruptcy planning, of trying to figure out, okay, we know the mantra, pigs can survive, but hogs get slaughtered. You can't overgrab on exemptions as you're converting non-exempt assets into exempt assets to help your client prepare for bankruptcy. But as we're trying to figure out, reading through this opinion, exactly what advice still is okay to tell a client, she tried to specify that it's only the type of bankruptcy advice that, in essence, I guess, hides meaningful assets from creditors that would be controverted. At the end of the day, I know a lot of good consumer debtor lawyers, and they have to figure out two things. One, is the traditional advice that I've always been giving my clients, which is you can only do legal things, but here are the legal things you can do before you file. Is that kind of traditional advice still allowed? And then the second question there is, all right, well, if it's not, who is actually going to tell on me? How does it find out? I think you find it out in bankruptcy when you do the 341 meeting of creditors and 2004 exams.
Yeah, and actually I'd like, this is an important question, and I'd like to turn it over as well to Joe and to Bill. I mean, Joe, as attorneys, we know that lawyers need to be able to have full and frank discussions with their clients. Nancy raised the question of, I don't know, reading the statute and reading the opinion, what kind of advice really I can and can't give. Joe, does anything come to your mind as advice to incur debt that would be abusive per se?
Well, let me come back to what advice you can and can't give.
Okay.
Under Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor's opinion. Justice Sotomayor made it clear several times in the opinion that lawyers have the ability to engage in a robust discussion with their clients, have the ability to have a full and frank discussion with their clients about all of their options, all of their possible actions, and all of their consequences. Because under the bankruptcy code as it's written now, for example, if you buy luxury goods on a credit card just before filing, that may not be dischargeable. Advice to do things or to buy things or to incur credit for things that would result in non-dischargeable debt, mm-hmm. or that would be found to be abusive under the bankruptcy statute, and this is a recommendation by the lawyer to engage in these activities, That sort of advice would be prohibited. On the other hand, having a full and frank discussion with your client about what would happen if you did X or if you did Y is not impeded or restricted at all under the statute or under the Milovic decision. So the way that I read the decision, lawyers can have that full and frank discussion. And Justice Sotomayor made it clear, I think, that if you're giving advice to a client to buy a more reliable car or to buy groceries mm-hmm. or to refinance your mortgage at a lower rate for a different purpose other than obtaining an asset and discharging the debt in bankruptcy, that was discharging the debt that was used to acquire that asset in bankruptcy, that advice is not going to be abusive at all. That's beneficial advice, and that's not advice that's going to get you in trouble. Advice where you're telling your client, the consumer client, to buy macaroni and cheese, that's fine. Advice to tell your client to buy caviar and champagne, that may not be good.
But it was never good.
It was never good. No, yeah. And this right. is not a restriction that's new to lawyers generally. For example, tax lawyers have always known that you can give advice with regard to tax avoidance, but not with regard to tax evasion. So this is a different regulation that's coming into the bankruptcy sphere that hadn't been there before. So as long as a lawyer is giving practical, straightforward advice about what actions or options a debtor has and what the consequences of those actions or choosing those options would be, and letting the debtor make that choice, that is not abusive at all. Recommendations to engage in abusive practices, that's prohibited. But that's again not new in the area of regulation of what advice attorneys can give. It's just now expanded into the bankruptcy sphere.
Now, Joe, the problem is under the First Amendment, it operates as a prior restraint because there isn't a clear line on what advice will be abusive. Your client wants to know whether or not to put on $5,000 braces on their child's teeth. Is that right before bankruptcy? So the issue now under Justice Sotomayor's decision is, was the bankruptcy an impetus mm-hmm. to putting on the braces? Apparently it's not. But the problem is the chilling effect where the lawyer does not want to be liable for the bill that's not discharged because the client may blame the lawyer on the advice, and the trustee seizes the lawyer's claim against the client's claim against the lawyer, and the lawyer is sued by the trustee for the advice. So we've got the government now overlooking that it should be almost a sacred relationship between the lawyer and the client, and the lawyer's advice is practical matter is going to be chilled with the risk of an FBI investigation, which is now allowed under the new BAPCPA, and a lawsuit without any protections as a malpractice lawsuit under state law would be for a debt that's incurred, according to the trustee, as a result of the advice. So the decision isn't that clear in all types of advice. If your client comes to you and tells you, my wife and I were waiting 50 years on our 50th anniversary to take this.
Hey, Bob?
Yes?
I just want to make sure, I think Joe, I want to make sure what Joe's saying here, and this is Chad again.
Uh-huh.
Are you saying that we've gone back to the pre-2005 loading up on bankruptcy by Sotomayor going and pulling back and narrowing the statute the way that she did?
Well, I think what Justice Sotomayor said was that if the advice that you're giving to your client is beneficial advice, in the examples that she gave were refinancing your house to obtain a lower interest rate and a lower monthly payment, for example, or buying a more reliable car that will carry you through, if the motivating purpose behind the decision, I believe is what Justice Sotomayor is saying, if the motivating purpose behind the decision to incur the debt is not to obtain an advantage, an abusive advantage in the bankruptcy case, then that advice is not going to be abusive, found to be abusive under the Act.
And so let's say that we're... Wait a minute.
How does the lawyer know what the intent of the client is going to be? The lawyer is charged with knowing the client's intent on whether to abuse the Act. That's why it still doesn't make sense.
Well, here, let's tag on to that, Bob, because you ask a really important question. Let's talk about what are the best practices going to be now for consumer debtor lawyers. How do they walk the line they need to give their clients the best possible advice that they can, consistent with this still amorphous idea of what kind of advice can they give that is not designed to abuse the system?
Well, one of the best practices I think that should be there is not advising your client to incur debt, which would be either A, determined not to be dischargeable, or B, that would trigger a finding by the bankruptcy court that the entire bankruptcy case was an abuse of filing, mm-hmm. and would deny your debtor the relief under the bankruptcy code. So if you are if you're giving your client advice to use a false financial statement to purchase an asset on credit, or to buy $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 worth of luxury items on a credit card on the eve of filing, that advice is I think prohibited under the statute. If you tell your client, on the other hand, that if you use a false financial statement to incur credit to buy an asset or to incur debt, that it might be found that you have to pay that back, that same debt back after you file bankruptcy, mm-hmm. that advice is clearly allowed and under this opinion. If you, as long as you're giving advice and detailing what the possible consequences are going to be, then you're allowed to give that full and frank advice to the client. There's no impediment to that whatsoever.
Yeah, and
saying that when a client comes to your office and they're telling you they may be leaving their husband, their husband's beating them and is a danger to them and the children, and they've got to get a new apartment, you're claiming you can give them good advice in view of the fact that, you know, they, with the divorce, they're probably going to have to go through bankruptcy because they can't pay off all the bills their husband has set up. Just the real world isn't as simple as that. There's gray areas in the decision, since it doesn't just say it's unconstitutional and void, the decision kind of narrow it, doesn't adequately narrow all of the issues that come up in a practitioner's practice.
Well, I think that's a very important point, and we're going to actually have to wrap up soon to take questions. So there are a couple of things I'd like to do. I mean, when it's very clear, you know, there's never a clear, bright line on what you can and can do. But I just wanted, I mean, Bill, do you have anything to add on this about the impact that the narrow reading of 526A4 has on the attorney-client relationship?
I agree with Joe that you can give free advice as to the consequences of an action. As I read Judge Sotomayor, she uses the word impelled.
Mm-hmm.
The decision to incur the debt must have been impelled by the bankruptcy. Impelled means directed or compelled. I went and looked it up in a couple of dictionaries.
Thank you.
and that's pretty strong. Now, there is a footnote 6,
mm-hmm.
in which she describes the examples and says, well, the principal motivation for incurring the debt has to be the bankruptcy. And that, maybe you could say that's watered down, but I think impelled, and she uses the word, I believe, 4 times, is pretty strong. So it's clear that the lawyer can give advice concerning the consequences. What the lawyer can't do advice directing or advising the client to take an action to incur debt that's impelled or principally motivated by the bankruptcy. I think that's broader.
Let me follow up on that, Bill, because it's really important. A buddy of mine who practices, and we all know this guy, practices in Seattle, Mark Stern, asked a really great question the first time we talked about this. Is, can you give advice on borrowing more in terms of manipulating the means test, or is that not allowed?
Well,
that's mentioned in the opinion.
Yeah.
If the principal reason for incurring the debt is manipulating the means test, and I think Judge Sotomayor would say that violates 526.4. Mm-hmm. It would not violate, I don't think, in my opinion, it would not violate the rules of professional conduct, which merely prohibit lawyers from advising a client to engage in fraudulent or criminal conduct.
Right.
Because incurring debt to fit within the means test is neither criminal nor fraudulent. So I think that Section 526A4 of the Bankruptcy Code goes further than the rules of professional conduct.
Right.
But again, I think you have to look to the principal reason or the impelling reason for incurring the debt.
And actually, before we open this up to questions, I'd like to ask a last question of you, Bill, which you just started to answer, which is the relationship between these provisions and state ethical rules. I mean, traditionally, lawyers are regulated by the states, yet the bankruptcy code has now a number of provisions that have been upheld that regulate attorney speech and advertising. What is the impact of this decision on a lawyer's obligations under his state's ethical rules?
Well, the American Bar Association filed an amicus brief also in support mm-hmm. of Bob, in which they raised this issue forcefully. And it's clear from Justice Sotomayor's opinion that the court took the ABA's brief into consideration. But the part that I found most alarming was where Justice Sotomayor brushed aside the argument that Congress, the federal government, doesn't regulate lawyers by saying, of course Congress does,
right,
and pointed to decisions dealing with the reasonableness of fees. Well, there's a long way between the reasonableness of fees and the attorney-client relationship. And the court made the jump to the attorney-client relationship here by permitting the Congress to legislate an area which isn't prohibited by the state rules of ethics and prohibiting lawyers from giving advice that would not be prohibited under the state ethics rules. So this clearly takes the intrusion of the federal government into the attorney-client relationship up a notch.
Great. Thank you. I think now, operator, we're ready for questions.
Okay. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. And once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. We will take a moment to allow questions to queue.
Okay.
And it appears we have no questions at this time.
Okay, well,
we've stunned them.
All right, if that's the case, let me ask each one of you for your concluding thoughts. Nancy?
I agreed with everything that Bill said in his last comments. I think one of the saddest things about the 2005 amendments and this case is that a lot of the alleged harms that Congress sought to cure in BAP-CIPA included the whole idea of false advertising by attorneys and trying to make sure that attorneys were clear about what they could and couldn't do. And when I wake up every morning, the first thing that I see on TV are lawyer ads, because now bankruptcy is trendy. And they say things that are impossible to do under bankruptcy, but at the end they say, we're a debt relief agency, we help people. And so really, if Congress wanted to solve the real problems, this was not the way to go about it. And I think you see the Supreme Court bending over backwards to try to make a very poorly drafted law be as constitutional as possible.
Thanks. Joe, you have any concluding thoughts?
Well, my biggest concern about this statute or the issues raised in the Milovic decision were whether or not lawyers could give full and frank advice to their clients mm-hmm. or advise their clients to incur debt which might be beneficial to them, such as refinancing a home or purchasing a reliable car. I think Justice Sotomayor's decision made it abundantly clear that attorneys are going to be able to give that full advice to clients without fear, that as long as they tell their clients what their options are and what the consequences are going to be or might be, then they've satisfied their ethical obligations under the state rules, and they've satisfied the statute. So I was pleased to see her very narrow reading of that section of the statute.
Great. Thanks. Bill?
I also was glad to see the narrow reading. I would have preferred and argued that the statute was unconstitutional. But if you couldn't win the constitutionality argument, then the narrow reading, I think, puts lawyers in a position where it's much easier to know what conduct you can engage in and what you can't, what advice you can give and what you can't. And in that respect, the opinion is a welcome addition.
Okay. And Bob and Chad, your last thoughts?
I think that the opinion was an attempt to maintain a law that's clearly unconstitutional. And I agree that lawyers can get around the law by telling the client the consequences, but it still leaves the client up in the air of what to do. I don't think it meets ethical requirements just to tell the consequences. They want to know, should they do it? Can they do it? Not just telling the consequences, because they don't know what the chances of the consequences are going to be. And the end result will be that lawyers are not going to give good, fair advice to clients, even though they're permitted under the statute to do so. And even though they won't be disbarred if they don't do so. Still, there's a chilling effect, and the purpose of the statute was to keep the clients from being informed. There was a case we cited, which I don't recall that was mentioned, 44 Liquors, where the state of Rhode Island decided that people shouldn't know the price of liquor because it would encourage drinking. And the U.S. Supreme Court held that that advertising statute was unconstitutional. It was a statute designed to protect the people from buying liquor. Similarly, this is a statute designed to protect people from learning about what the consequences of doing certain acts. And the statute certainly is going to have a chilling effect, and a lawyer is going to be deterred from advising the client over certain purchases and certain consequences of certain charges.
Well,
Thomas, when he really addressed that in his concurring opinion, the number one thing of my concern that I saw coming out of it, and that was probably most upsetting to me to the point that I went and worked out last night to the point of exhaustion. But the public's rights were left out of the opinion as far as the right to receive information, a yes or a no answer from their attorney instead of an ambiguous answer. And they're not even mentioned in the opinion, their right to go and receive it. It's a sad day for attorneys because they're not sure what they can do, but it's an even worse day for our clients because we're not able to tell them, yes, you can do this, or no, you can't do this. And I think that's what I took from the opinion, and that's what hit me the hardest when I've gone through it. Because our clients were parties, and our clients were not just Milovic, Gallup, Milovic, right. Robert Milovic, Barb and Nevin. There was also two clients that wanted to go and incur more debt before filing for bankruptcy to put them in a better economic position.
And now we find out that the Supreme Court didn't even want to hear what they had to say.
Well, thank you. That's a great thought on which to conclude this. It was a very significant case, giving the Supreme Court to the opportunity to opine on provisions of the bankruptcy code that a lot of lawyers really don't like. And I think, as some of you have pointed out, it was good to see a narrow reading of these provisions. But as others of you have pointed out, maybe it does not give the best guidance that it could give. So I thank all of you for participating in this very informative teleconference.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Okay.